Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. It's great to have John McMurtry back. We'll have a exhilarating hour. Maybe that's one way to describe it. John, it's been a very active media day for me. This morning, I was on Press TV, a brief interview on what they call their top five program. They had their lead story, which surprised me because they cover a lot of vital issues. Their lead story today was on Israel literally wanting to, in its negotiations with Palestinians, literally maintain total militarized police state control of the West Bank. And Israel's idea of a peace agreement is really just that. You know, we maintain control. We have all the rights. We give you none. You know, you live here as long as we allow you to live here. And that's the deal we offer, take it or leave it. So I got to talk for about 5 minutes on that. And then I had my first, I sent you a brief email on this. I had my first ever in translation interview on a Venezuelan radio station, and they picked I think it was accidental that they picked today because there are municipal elections going on in Venezuela right now, and I have an article written on it. I think I'm going to get it out later this afternoon and then write a new one tomorrow once the results are out. I can't write about the results because people are still voting, but late into the evening, I think maybe most of the results will be out, over 90% of them, so we'll have a pretty good idea how things turn out. So this is my third time on air. I'm ready for a quartet, John.
Sorry, I didn't hear the last comment, Steve.
Well, I'm ready for a fourth interview.
Oh.
A fourth time on air.
Well, you know, there's the things you're referring to, we've talked about a lot in the past. I think with Israel, it's always important to remind ourselves what the press, including most of the Middle Eastern press, even the victims themselves do not, and their leaders do not identify what is the Israeli occupation is. It's a war crime. It is the crime above all other crimes, and the occupation and taking of their lands and the forced removal of the people and the apartheid walls. Everything that Israel does is a war crime and a crime against humanity under law. And one just cannot repeat that enough because it is never, ever acknowledged. They'll always put it as, you know, there's two equal forces and they're both, you know, at the best, they're both belligerent or they're both unreasonable, and thus the struggle goes on and it's over such a little small piece, and on it goes. And no one ever says, and it's interesting because I'll do this with Jewish friends who are for the occupation, which are, I can't really say they're friends, whereas most Jews I know are very much against it, recognize, but even those who are for it say, when I say, well, what you're talking about here is justifying a major war crime, in fact, the longest ongoing war crime in history, and the crimes against humanity that are going on. You can't deny that. It's all true in fact, and you know it. So, but we've talked about that lots before. The Iran, we've talked about lots before. This new settlement, albeit completely one-sided in terms of, you know, Iraq must do all the deferral, and Iran must do this and Iran must do that. Meanwhile, a big atomic power that that has, you know, many atomic weapons in store, ready to use, and indeed always threatening to use, that's fine, but the neighbor next door isn't, with a much bigger country, isn't allowed to have any. I mean, the whole thing is really quite grotesque, but nonetheless, I am very glad that some settlement was reached, because that puts a stop, although it's been very distressing, the way, I mean, Netanyahu is threatening that he's going to bomb them. He, you know, therefore, you know, once the U.S. and the Europe gets on side with some sort of stop of these crippling sanctions, which, by the way, are illegal under international law as well, once they stop that, at least Iran has a chance of surviving as a country, which is why Netanyahu is screaming loud about why this is the greatest threat of all, because Iran might survive. And the fact that Netanyahu is screaming and yelling along with his, ironically, Saudi allies, that they're screaming loud and clear about how this has destroyed peace or is a great threat to peace in the Middle East in the future, indicates to me that something right has been done here. But you know, when this agreement was reached, they said, well, you know, Israel, you know, basically calling Israel Netanyahu's bluff, they have the right as a nation to attack Iran if they want. But once they'd withdrawn the vindication of that and the justification of that and the armed backing of that attacking Iran, it's not a viable option for Israel to do. But it was still quite amazing to me that they said, they didn't warn Israel saying, you will only compound the war crimes and the crimes against humanity by the supreme crime of all, which is an attack, not in self-defense. They didn't indicate, as they never do, any crime against international law. They just said, they just called the bluff and said, you'll do it if you have to. Moving on to Venezuela, which was your third mention, I mean, of course you know, but probably nobody listening may know that Venezuela is under attack continuously by the U.S. They've had to expel diplomats there because they say, you know, they are contriving with the right and planning with the right for what they always do is a coup d'état. And right now, since that's not really effective, they've tried that and it hasn't succeeded. They are crippling the economy. They're sabotaging the economy in all sorts of ways. Directly sabotaging, according to Maduro, they're directly sabotaging their infrastructure, and they're sabotaging in the way we knew from Chile on. They sabotage through closing down the business, the corridors of business, and putting the prices up and so forth. Anything to make the people there, become very, very restive about their government and being another pretext for another coup and perhaps an American intervention. All of that is going on a daily basis, and according to reports, is very serious indeed what's going on in Venezuela. So we see this spectrum, and we'll notice the same pattern, which I won't go all over in a way I've already indicated, the same pattern of war criminal behavior, war criminal threats, sabotage of anything that opposes the money cancer system, the global money cancer system, but resistance and crises are arising all over the place. We were going to get to Mandela eventually, but you know, there's also this conflict over the Diu Islands, as they're called in Chinese, and there's also the Ukraine that you've written so well about and so on. So we're seeing a massive spectrum of events occurring right now. The connections aren't drawn between the dots, but they're there, and I'm having a bit of hopefulness about some of the turns that are happening, like the agreement with Iran. But make no mistake, the forces of the global money cancer system are all behind everything that is going wrong.
John, there's no question about that. And I always like to maintain hope. I say to myself, and I tell others, that if I lose hope, or if anyone loses hope, you literally lose everything.
Yeah.
So, I mean, because I have hope, it drives me in what I do every day. At the same time, I'm skeptical about U.S. policy. As far as Iran goes, John, it's impossible for me to believe that a few meetings in Geneva will erase 34 years of U.S. anti-Iranian sentiment. And I think, and Obama literally, and I've proved it in my many articles about him. I could fill a few books with the articles I've written about him in the last six years, 2008 to the present time, that literally he has broken every major promise he made. And you simply have to ignore everything that he says and watch only what he does. Of course, this is true for all politicians. One more thought, John. In June 2009, he went to Cairo University just a few months into his presidency, and he talked about a new day in American-Muslim relations. He wanted it based on, you know, human rights and all the rest of the stuff that they like to talk about. And what's happened in the past 5 years? Wars on Libya, Syria, the Iraq war still rages. You get car bombs exploding all over the place on a daily basis because of America's war.
But it could have been a lot worse, Steve. He could have gone in. This is where I think I'm glad Obama's in the White House. Well, there's two points I really want to make. No matter who's in the White House, as you know, there's a great machine, and we talked about it in our last discussion nearing the anniversary of the assassination of Jack Kennedy. That the system is an autonomous system, the covert state system. It's a covert criminal organization that will shoot presidents too if they get out of line. And so he's really just been put in as a figurehead, backed by corporate money along. You know, it's just basically which money party wins. And so we really couldn't expect that much that he promised would come through, given that larger system that has been going since the Second World War and becoming worse and worse and more totalitarian. He has, however, Bush would have done something about Iraq, about Syria. Probably would have. I mean, the Europeans were ready to go in and so forth. But there's another sign of hope. The president can really can only do what a large constituency, a clear majority of the American people support. And so he didn't go in. The Americans did not go in to Syria. And there was all sorts of, denunciation for that and, for being indifferent to the suffering of the Syrian people and all the usual stuff. And he didn't go in, though, because he had a constituency to back him. And they haven't bombed Iran the way it was always continuously talked about. They've made an agreement with Iran, and again, screaming and yelling and hollering from Israel and from Saudi Arabia, its partner, and of course from the right wing in the Congress, which is very strong. So these are significant moves. The recent move he made talking about a minimum wage, he did bring in a horrible health care program, but at least more people are covered than were before. So I think with Obama, I agree with you that every promise he made, one can read accurately it as having been violated, not having been fulfilled. But on the other hand, I see certain moves having been made, ones I've just referred to, that indicate that it could be a lot worse. And that Obama really depends upon, because he is a figurehead inside that system, it's an imperialist, bloodthirsty, war criminal system that is largely covert, and it'll kill a president if he gets in out of line. I think that's one of the reasons for Mandela, by the way. We see how, which we might get into, in terms of whether there's hope or there isn't hope. Here's a guy, Mandela, who you've written well about, but almost nobody else has, in terms of, he has all sorts of promises. But, I mean, Mandela, he said the nationalization, when he got out of prison, 2 weeks before he got out of prison, he said, talk about broken promises. Obama's a piker on one level next to Mandela. He says, quote, the nationalizations of the mines, banks, and monopoly, excuse me, and monopoly industries is the policy of the ANC, and the change or modification of our views in this regard is inconceivable. And then later on, what he goes on to say is that the ANC has never stood for any of these things. The ANC has always been for private property and the free market and privatization. He's completely reversed what he said, and yet he, you know, comes out as a great hero because certain things he did in, you know, once he was out of office, but it may be, you know, his successor, Chris Haney, or likely successor, was murdered. And I think that if Mandela had stood behind these things that he was arguing for back then, that he would have been murdered. And it may well be, you know, I mean, the U.S., you know, originally had him arrested. The U.S. were the people, I mean, it was the CIA who located where Mandela was in order to arrest him. They didn't know the South African police force and Secret Service didn't know how they could get Mandela, and all that information was fed to them by the CIA, and he was arrested on their instructions. They gave the exact, you know, what car he was disguised as, a chauffeur, that he would be leaving a meeting at a certain time, and he'd be dressed as in such a way, and he would be occupying this role. So they had total inside information, and that's how Mandela got arrested. So if he had stayed by what he said, he, you know, there's a problem here. It's not just liars in the head office. There's certainly that is a pathology that daily disturbs me to my marrow. But on the other hand, the system that is behind them, which is ultimately nowadays, and it grew up later, largely during Mandela's reign, and also, of course, has gone ballistic, as it were, in terms of its spread under Obama, this system will murder anybody who does stand up for the good. So it's not just a question of there being big liars. It's a question of the deeper question, a deeper structural system that is altogether life blind in principle, and increasingly criminal and totalitarian in its operations, because it is, after all, it can only be diagnosed, the only diagnosis that fits all the facts, is that it's a transnational money cancer system. That is, it just multiplies itself at the expense of all the other functions of the life body, from the life support systems of the atmosphere to whether people have enough to eat in a poor family in the United States as they cut their supplies. And it's all going, all the money's flowing in towards that which has no function, that just multiplies itself and spreads and debilitates and destroys all life organization around it. That's the real problem. We've talked a lot about that too. But we should, I mean, all the things that are going on now, the TEPCO thing I'd like to get in with you too, the Honduras thing I'd like to get in to you, the Ukraine, the Diu Islands that are off the coast of China. All of these are crises that are popping up all over the place, and they all have the same causal mechanism behind them. For example, one of the ones we might go talking about, the big lie, if we leave Mandela behind for a moment, is the one that you've written well about, and again, no, you know, it's being reported in the mass media and the press, including even the public radio station, which I listen to, that Ukraine is fighting against oppression, and it's going to... It's refusing to join the European Union, and that brings up the whole issue of the European Union, which talk about the promises being violated by the actions, especially since 1991, 1995, especially since the Maastricht Treaty. The contradictions there are greater than we'll find with Obama and Mandela. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's a bankocracy that, you know, the cancer is straight on there. It just, all those crises are about paying off the private bankers in the private bank system. They're just hollowing out the whole society to grab it all, and now they've got a European stabilization law or stabilization mechanism, I guess they call it, a financial stabilization mechanism, and that allows them to draw out of the accounts of the governments. They can just take without any right of refusal or any right of any resistant action by legal course or procedures of taking out as much money they want out of national accounts. And now they're moving into taking it all out of people's personal accounts. And the Germany, who's at the head of the whole thing, you know, that's the one society that's working. 25% of its people have no steady jobs. They have no real livelihood, even in Germany, which is the most successful society in the West, so-called. So we're dealing here with an increasing, systemic, worldwide crisis where the big lie rules in every case, and of course that's what we try to do, is decode the big lie, see through what the actual mechanism of determination is going on here, and we're seeing it now happening. There's two things that I'll leave it there. We're seeing that happening in more sort of a wider spectrum of places than normal, you know, like the weather, you know, the destabilized climate and hydrological cycles. We have the destabilization having of the system of itself. And, of course, we have going along with this a ever more totalized big lie of justification with all its variations in every place. And in every place we can identify what the big lies are better than we've been able to do in the past, largely because of our information system is no longer completely under the control of corporate press.
Well, indeed so, John, and there's no question that the cancer money system is really the power running everything, certainly in Western countries and other countries as well, but mainly in Western countries and especially America. I mean, the power of Wall Street, the big money banks, the other big financial interests, the insurance companies, the big real estate interests, I mean, these are all money interests, and they're interconnected with other big corporations. They work cooperatively. They co-opt government. I mean, America literally gets the best democracy money can buy. That's the kind of system America has. Elections are absolutely fake. Anybody who wastes their time voting for Republican or Democrat, you might as well go out and vote for IBM or Exxon. I mean, that's basically what you're doing. Or J.P. Morgan or Bank of America. I mean, that's what a vote for either of those parties mean. And again, there's so much going on in the world.
You're voting,
John,
for one party, money party or another. But
exactly.
Let me just say again, I think there's a qualification that we should recognize here, that one money party, you know, it's like the good cop and the bad cop, in a way. One money party, and now the Republicans, is fascist in nature and is absolutely out of control, and it's demented, really. It's one might say brain dead. Then the other money party, which are called the Democrats, and you know which Obama leads as president, is still a money party, and it will do nothing that transgresses the interests of its financial supporters and its media supporters. And the media, of course, are just a collective executive committee, as it were, for all the corporations, in the sense that they have all. Their whole accounts are dependent upon contributions through advertisements of corporations. So they're representing the collective interests of the corporations, all the mass media. And so you're not going to get anything that happens that contradicts the interests of that system. What you will have is, instead of mindless war crime continuously, you will have little gleams of possible light at the end of the tunnel from the other, with a different kind of motivation. I think Obama's a con man. Indeed, you'd have to be a con man to rise to that position. Although you saw with Kennedy, for example, he changed his position, really, and matured in office, built character in office, and he was murdered. I think it makes a difference whether you had voted for Kennedy or whether you had voted for Obama, in the sense of, well, what do you want? You're going to get the same system until there's an uprising. and it, you know, they can't go on with it. And of course, that's what did work. In fact, was they couldn't go into Syria because the public just wouldn't back it. Not even the full Republican phalanx. So, if you have the rising of the people who will not take it anymore, then that's the only chance, as you recognize. But it makes a difference, the vote. Which one, you know, which movement they're going to represent. We have a very well-organized movement from the Koch brothers, for example, the oil billionaires, you know, the Tea Party. And, you know, that's the movement they're running, and basically that's to dismantle all government and all safety nets and all public spending on anything but more money for them at the front. Makes a difference whether you vote for them or you vote for the party that only goes part way with that. I mean, it's like the old Clinton thing, too. We saw it again and again. Well, you know, the Republicans wanted to cut $375 billion, and he said this himself, the difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. And the Democrats only wanted to, would only cut $360 billion from the, you know, life support systems for the needy and the less well-off and the job insecure. So I think it does look at it.
Mostly Medicare, some from Medicaid, also cutting Social Security. I do believe, I can't prove
Endless.
It, but I do believe that Obama wants those programs privatized, handed over to Wall Street bankers. And if this isn't a way to destroy people's savings, I mean, we're seeing a war on pensions right now, right here in my home state of Illinois. There's a war on public pensions where people save their entire working lives and they retire. I mean, their money going in, state money, I mean, a contract between the state of Illinois and its public workers, and now there are big cuts in the pension plan. Well, you'll get the same thing going on a federal basis, and of course Medicare, which is so important.
Right now, yeah.
I mean, all of these things going on. Again, the great wealth transference, John, well, you know, stealing from the Robin Hood in reverse.
Yeah, it's more than a transfer. It's a hijacking, a violent hijacking through the small print that defends nothing but the interests of multiplying private money. And it will take everything. I mean, the you know, they're going to cut back. I'd like to ask you, by the way, about the Obama. We'll just hold that for a second. Why you think, because that privatization of the Social Security system and pensions, what makes you think that? You may well be right, no doubt. But they're taking these pensions away now already so that the people are not getting even what they paid into. They're being robbed even at the level of, it's not just taking away their public pension, it's taking away their own investment in their pension. That's already happened. They're getting the middle class are now having their pensions reduced, let alone taken away, which is a more extreme form that's going on. They're having their pension, the pensions that are due, are being reduced to less than what they themselves put into with non-inflated money. So it really is a ravaging system. Again, why the carcinogenic diagnosis is the only one that fits. But Bush wanted to do this, privatize Social Security and pensions, and your view is that Obama wants to do that. And what's the facts that that's based on?
My main reasoning, John, is that Bush was. His last term in office was, his last year in office was 2008. The economic crisis was just beginning, and we had the TARP program. There were so many hundreds of billions of dollars. I forget the exact amount. Maybe it was 800 odd billion dollars that was given to the banks. But Obama just did that multifold, where Obama literally gave, I think in excess, we don't know the number because the Federal Reserve hit it and the Treasury hit it, but it's possible. I remember quoting Neil Barofsky, who was the administrator of the TARP program, and he said possibly it amounted to as much as $23.5 trillion.
Yes,
if I remember this figure accurately.
That's an accurate. I think that comes right out of. I mean, now that has been established by Congress, congressional statistics, that it was over 17. So now it may, because they're giving out a trillion a year, basically, and since that figure was I would think that was an accurate figure.
Oh, absolutely. Fed is printing $1 trillion of money, handing it to Wall Street banks.
Yeah.
And the other thing in my mind, John, is Wall Street has just been crying for the privatization of Medicare and Social Security for years. And the Bush administration tried to give it to them, and there was a public uproar.
Yes.
I think Obama wants to do it more covertly. But, you know, we'll have to wait and see, and it scares me if it happens.
Yeah.
It means the end of the systems if it happens. That's what it means. John, we need to take a quick break. Let's do that, and we'll come right back. So much more to talk about.
Yes.
Welcome back. On with John McMurtry. John, let me just say a quick word about Ukraine. And I mention Ukraine because it's a topic that very few people think about, but it's a lot more important than most people imagine. In 2004, there was a Washington-instigated so-called Orange Revolution. It overthrew a democratically elected government. There was hell to pay for Ukrainians for years, from 2004 until 2010. Well, things have been really bad because the economic crisis broke in 2008.
Just as a matter of information, Steve, that in fact, their GNP fell by 60%. During that period.
Oh, I didn't know the figure, John.
Yeah,
it was worse than I thought, but it was absolutely terrible. A country was literally raped by the West. That's what the Orange Revolution was all about. And I wrote an article that I titled Orange Revolution 2.0 with a question mark. Is it happening again? And it's amazing. Gore Vidal used to call America the United States of amnesia. Where ordinary people couldn't remember last year's ripoff as their pockets are being picked again this year. And apparently Ukrainians are an awful lot of them, not the whole country. Sentiment is pretty split down the middle, either east or west, favoring the government or against, or wanting a UN alliance, as these provocateurs on the streets want. But what's going on is real thuggery on the streets, manipulated by Washington, using EU nations as a cat's paw, really serving U.S. imperial interests. And of course the EU countries get a piece of the action too, and the idea is to rape Ukraine all over again.
Yeah.
And pull it out of the Russian orbit to gain total control. The West, mainly Washington, wants all the former Soviet republics out of its control, under its control. It wants Russia increasingly isolated, China increasingly isolated. Of course, U.S. military bases encircle these countries. This is the dirty game that's going on, and it's playing out right now on the streets of Kiev in Ukraine. The opposition, John, called for at least 1 million to come out in March today. Earlier this morning, Russia Today had a live feed. There was no commentary, just feed as people were milling around. It was maybe 3 in the afternoon Kiev time. It was a big crowd, but it was nowhere near 1 million.
No, they divide by 4 when it's a protest, and they multiply by, this is something I've actually followed, and they multiply by at least 4 when it's in line with the imperial interest. there's much, you know, actually that's an hypothesis that I've tracked and found why myself have been in a demonstration and the figures reported, you know, trying to do the best estimate you could by lines of people going by and so forth, that I've seen more, you know, that these were reported in the press as divided by 4, basically was the rule of thumb. And then they multiply by more than 4 if it's going the other way. It's in the interests of the plan. But the thing about Ukraine is that it's a much bigger prize than you might think. I deduced as soon as the Ukraine thing started to happen, and the EU, by the way, its bankocracy is more out of control than Wall Street, and won by Wall Street men. So that people who've actually been trained by Wall Street, presidents and so on, I mean, that have been appointed and the elections overridden. I mean, the European Union has gone from a social democracy that way back when, that is in my book, Value Wars 2002, I took as an example of a social democratic state that was, you know, the largest, and it had all kinds of standards, life standards in place that were tracked, monitored, and insured. And its people were, you know, until this whole globalization cancer money sequencing came in, they were a very advanced society. Now, of course, they're in collapse, and it, like the cancer always has to grow. That's the thing about cancer. It'll go into remission, but it will, and maybe it'll be beaten on the micro level as well as the macro level, but it will grow everywhere it can, and it will multiply itself everywhere it can. And Ukraine is a very big prize. I don't know whether you knew that Ukraine has the largest land. It's the biggest country in Europe. It's got more land than anybody in Europe.
Well, of course, Russia's a pretty big country.
Russia's only partly in Europe.
Oh, yeah. And very much of it is in
Asia. And not really with Ukraine out. Russia's got nothing in Europe. So, the reason why they want to deal with the Russians are that they have no energy, you see, in Ukraine. They have no native energy supply, but I deduce they must have found one because they're talking about, you know, it's another overthrow scenario going into play here. And I looked it up, and sure enough, there has been recent big gas discoveries that a foreign multinational owns, Poland and Germany. And so that's a good reason. You know, you can predict it. Where there's a crisis, they found some new resources, just like with Syria. I mean, it was only after the new resources were found, very significant gas resources and so on, that this whole thing happened in Syria, that you can deduce it. But it's not just the oil. That has given her the gas. That has given them what they didn't have any of before, and completely dependent on Russia. And Russia gives it to them at a discount rate. That's never talked about. You know, Russia's always bullying them and so forth. It just says, well, we'll pull out, you know, you won't get it at a discount rate. And that is, with a country without any of its own native power under its control, that's a very big consideration. But it's not just the land mass, and it's not just the newly discovered fossil fuel deposits, which are in billions of feet. It's the breadbasket of the whole continent, the European, the Asian. It's the third biggest producer of grains in the world, in the whole world.
John, if I got it right, and I hope I got it right, it's potential arable land, and it's very valued arable land, dark soil, that apparently is very rich.
Yeah.
It's as large as the state of Texas.
Yeah. Well, that's a good step. So, you know, just compounds what I'm saying. This is a very big prize indeed, especially as, you know, the arable land, and this is what feeds the money cancer system, is that as it destroys the arable land through basically mining and looting it, you know, and so it has no nutritional capacities left, then it has to grab more land. And how is it going to grab more land but go for the place that has land that they don't totally control yet? And so that's the real prize here, is this arable land. That's the third, and already that arable land that's bigger, as you say, than Texas itself, already it's the third biggest producer of grains in the world, and far bigger than anybody else in Europe. So the cancer money sequence cancer system will obviously go after this, and it'll only be when, you know, the majority of people rise up and stop it. And in this case, we have a head of state that I think you put it well when you said Ukraine just dodged the bullet. That land is, and everything else was going to be taken away from them, and they're going to be put under the control now. Not, it didn't used to be the case. It would have been good for Ukraine to join the Europe 25 years ago. But now it's going to just be more for the bankocracy, the private money sequences to swallow up, which they've already swallowed up a good deal of it, but they're going to swallow it up totally, and it'll be under the terms of the European financial system. And the European financial system is that you can't, that all all the money that is in your state possession, in your government possession, all the public wealth is going to is now ours. You cannot spend it on anything that, for example, you can't spend it on. You can't change its value. You can't invest with it. All of these are possibilities are written out by the very rules of the so-called European Union since the bankocracy took over. I mean, you can't increase or decrease your money supply. It's all got to be left in to the control of the bankocracy. And you can't spend anything more than 3% of your GDP. You know why that is? Because 97% is created by the private banks. They create 97% of the money supply. So they make a rule that no government is allowed to have more than 3%. You'll never see that mentioned anywhere. I don't even know whether you've identified that one, and you're a real expert on
Wall
Street.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, but Europe's worse. Europe's worse. And so they also allow, the whole thing is you're always in debt. And who puts you in debt? Well, to the bankocracy. And the bankocracy, just basically wants to multiply its money. And so in order to pay them, and the payment, exceeds all probably, can exceed all other expenditures put together. So what you're doing in order to pay it, and the IMF will enforce this with a financial embargo and so forth, is permanent raids, therefore, on all public infrastructure and all public employment and all social programs, wind it down to nothing. And that's why all the riots are going on. And then you call all this financial discipline, and you say this is necessary to pay down the debt. This we must get out of deficit, and just on and on, the sky's falling in on deficit. And all of that translated means all your wealth has to be transferred to the private cancer money sequence system, all of it. We have to have a right to all of it. Well, Ukraine's outside the Union. We can't get it. It's the third biggest agricultural producer in the world. It's the biggest country in Europe and so on. Well, that's, as you know, the whole banking system doesn't really invest in loans to those who need it, small business or people. It rules out loans to government for spending other than what they demand and what they have written right into the rules. And so it has to expand as you're destroying everything else. And, the derivative speculation, a lot of it is on food. And this will be very, very important to have control of. The thing is to get control of that which people need and depend upon through debt, and then speculate it in derivatives to cream them again on the prices of goods. And the biggest country in Europe with the greatest agricultural capacity is sitting just like a sitting duck. And nobody puts these things together, of course, in the mass media, although, of course, I do in my book, The Cancer Stage of Capitalism, From Crisis to Cure. Even, when this first came in, I was alarmed when this first came in, the Maastricht Treaty back in the, and it's been repeated, it's just been instituted and increased since then. But even the people on the left were saying, oh, no, this is good, this will stop currency attacks and so on. The key, you see, is the con. You can't get away with all this stuff unless you con the people, like the way Mandela got conned, the way his successor was completely conned into being a Thatcherite, the way the Ukrainian people are being conned now. The only place they're not being conned is there are places like in many countries of Latin America. They've woken up to the con, but they're still subject to attacks of every kind. But you have to have the con go through, and where the people are so ideologically conditioned to think only of the, for example, with Mandela in South Africa, they kept everybody's attention on the personal dispute between Mandela and de Klerk, who were bargaining over political civic structures. And all the time they were doing that, They were just taking over the banks. They were taking, you know, that the bank cannot be anything but private and it cannot be subject to government, the independence of the central bank, that you cannot invest because the job plans and houses and all the other things they promised, because all of that had been taken away from them by the negotiations going on, led by Mbeki, who by the end of it, he had become a Thatcherite and called himself a Thatcherite. They just completely conned not only the people had been fighting for something much more, but they conned their negotiators, and I think the same is going on, for example, with Ukraine or with the U.S. itself. The con that's in, that's all of this is necessary, that we must pay our debts, we must pay down our deficit, when all of it has been hijacked by a private banking system that has nothing in mind except taking it all from you, and we must pay them above all else. And people, that's the new matter of honor, is paying your debts to who? Somebody who created the money, a private institution who created 97% of the money out there through their loan and speculation system. So Ukraine is a paradigm example, and I'm glad you brought it up, because these things only go by us once, whether it becomes a social issue. Otherwise, people don't even see it. The Mandela thing, you know, all the panegyrics about Mandela came by us, and we only have one shot, really, at explaining what's going on there. Otherwise, people will just turn off. But once it's this is a problem with the popular intelligence. It's conditioned and addicted to spectacle events, and won't really pay attention otherwise. So it's only when the spectacle events go by, like Mandela dying or the Ukraine streets being full of people wanting, being conned into thinking the European Union will be good for them, it's only then that we're going to actually be able to deconstruct what's going on, because otherwise people will just turn out. If it isn't a spectacle, it isn't a TV spectacle for me on the screen, I'm not going to pay attention. So that's why I'm glad you brought up Ukraine.
Well, people mostly pay attention to pocketbook issues, John. You know, the only time they look at other issues is when big government lies scare them about some kind of a threat, you know, a terrorist threat or whatever.
Always the big lie.
I always put a capital B and a capital L to emphasize the big lie. And unfortunately, there are many big lies. They just keep continuing. And people get sucked into believing them all too often. You would think they'd wise up after a couple of times, but the old Abe Lincoln statement about you can fool some of the people all of the time and all of the people some of the time. Well, he was wrong on the latter. He said you can't fool all of the people all the time. Well, you're right. You can't fool them all, but you fool too damn many of them all of the time.
Yeah,
and it literally lets America get away with murder.
Yeah, well, you do fool, because you do fool all of them all of the time, insofar as people don't get down and recognize the causal mechanism at work and what the resolution to it is. I mean, almost nobody gets there. You know,
it's
disallowed
true,
in the academy. You're not allowed to talk about it, not because of the way it's. I mean, the big lie gets by. How can it get by all these very well-trained and intelligent, most intelligent people that are in the academies and universities across our countries? How can you con them? You'd think that they would have the intelligence to see through. It's what I call methodological censorship. The method of the discipline has been constructed itself to not look at the issues that need to be raised in order to see what's going on and to do something about it. You have an a priori exclusion of those issues, so that even if you're talking about justice, everybody loves justice, what you'll have is the subject discipline itself, and there are a number of causal influences involved in why the subject discipline turns this way, but it has turned this way in all of them, one of them being that you would only fund, because originally when you got these disciplines being funded, they were being funded by Rockefeller Institute and so forth. The whole of the LSE was funded by American money. the Institute, Rockefeller Institute, and so forth. There's a whole bunch of them, as you know. They structured these disciplines to rule out anything that we're talking about a priori. So my expertise is, while I'm a philosopher, I've been a professor of philosophy for a long time, but I've also spoken a good deal, and I'm also recognized as a political scientist and an economist and so forth, you know, the social sciences as well as philosophy. And so I've given a lot of papers. I've given papers in 12 different disciplines around the world because you can't. You have to connect these things together. You're not going to understand any of them. But I'm a freak by doing that because all of their disciplines are structured to be siloed disciplines so that you cannot make the connections. You cannot join the dots because the method itself is structured against it. And to go outside the method is to risk your future livelihood. I figured there was no point doing anything else but you'd be amazed at how that's basically a freak, that doesn't happen. People just run for cover as soon as you start connecting across your disciplines. In fact, it's even considered immoral to speak beyond the discipline as it's been structured to rule out all these issues. So that, back to the issue of justice, we have very famous work of John Rawls on justice and many works since for and against. But all of the justice theory and philosophy that you find where you'd think you'd finally come to grips with these things rules it all out. Because to begin with, as with economics, to begin with, the only thing that can be seen are the preferences of atomic agents, individual agents. There is no people. There is no family. There is no social life support systems. There is no natural life support systems. They're all ruled out a priori in every discourse before you even sit down to talk about it. That's how bad it is in the academies. And so, of course, the money cancer system can run amok because no one's able to see it because of the lenses that they have instituted in their minds as the method of their disciplines. So it's a, you know, that you, then you come along, you're a freak too. You're a businessman in the sense of being a very unusual phenomenon that all the structures are there to rule out. But that, you know, once you went into retirement, you were able finally to do your work because you had an independent income. And that's the only way even someone like, same, that's the only way thinking has ever really been able to advance is through somehow you have an independent income so you're not locked into the system.
John, I emphasize small business
yeah.
with a small s,
yeah.
And I would also emphasize that it was a very cyclical business, and we never got 10 cents in government aid. I think if we ever asked for any, we'd have been laughed at, suggesting
the government
possibility.
Subsidies is another huge selector against ever doing anything. I know a guy who's trying to grow legumes, very well known guy, and he's done this, Wes Jackson. He's done this in a farm in the States, you know, where you try to have a closed circuit that everything you need for a farm to produce vegetables is available on the farm, so that even the diesel that runs your tractor comes from products of the farm, which, you know, fantastic, way ahead of the world really on this organic farming. I asked him, he became a friend because, you know, because we take these stands and you don't see many people who do. And he had not, in 40 years, he had not received 1 cent of the huge subsidies. It's $1 billion a day of subsidies that are going out to big agribusiness. And he didn't get 1 cent for the most advanced possibilities of farming that would overcome all the problems we have, land depletion and so forth, and, you know, the soil no longer being capable of raising product. He had moved beyond that with this inventive research and didn't get a cent. When I said, well, do you get any subsidy from the government? It's huge because you don't run anything now. All the corporate system is run on government subsidies. And he didn't. He just laughed and said, not a cent. In fact, if they could, they'd take away what I did on my own. They did.
John,
yeah.
We are out of time.
Wow.
The hour goes by too fast. I wish we had more time. I've got to cut in. I'm waiting for the band to strike up, but I know it's warming up and just about to tell me get off the air. John, it's been a very important hour. I look forward to getting you back next month. There's so much to talk about. We both know these issues are not going away. If it isn't Ukraine, it's someplace else. There's always a lot of commotion. There's always a lot of dust kicked up by America, and it isn't good dust. It's toxic dust.
It is.
John, again, my great, great thanks. Join us again next week. Fridays always at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.